9 million financial records known as the Pandora Papers were leaked, which reveal the offshore financial assets of many internationally well-known persons. Joining the conversation to shed light on what you could do to ensure that you are compliant with your tax obligations as we reflect upon the release of the Pandora Papers is Senior Associate in the Tax and Exchange Control Practice at Cliff Dekker Hofmeyer, Louis Botha. Mr. Botha, good evening and thank you so much for joining us.
Good evening, Benito. Good to be with you and your listeners.
I suppose those who know Louis will always be able to find a legal loophole. I mean, what has the Pandora Papers revealed?
Yeah, so Benito, essentially, what they've revealed is a significant amount of information that was, I suppose, best described as information that was supposedly hidden or that was structured or financial interest that was structured in such a way that with the aim of amounts being taxed or untaxed in very low tax jurisdictions. So what they really revealed is how many wealthy people around the world structure their affairs. They did not, per se, reveal any illegality. For example, what you had a few years ago with the Panama Papers.
Yes.
But what they revealed is the extent of offshore wealth that many internationally well-known persons own. So there's some well-known singers, some former politicians. So it's more about information, the fact that it has come to light that these interests and these offshore structures exist.
I suppose there was a lot of interest around this, particularly with former state leaders and politicians as well being revealed in terms of their financial investments. I mean, it may not be illegal, but is it ethical?
Yeah, and I think that's the real question. You know, I think to give a bit of context, it would be helpful to understand that the international tax landscape has, you know, so moved from, you know, historically you had the two terms, you had tax evasion and tax avoidance, and the key focus that has arisen in the last few years is whether certain forms of tax avoidance is lawful and legal. And so, for example, you have laws in different countries. South Africa, I'll just use South Africa as an example. South Africa, for example, has a set of special provisions in the Income Tax Act, known as the colloquial term is the GAR, or the so-called general anti-avoidance rules, whereby even if something does not constitute brazen tax evasion, if it constitutes tax avoidance, and it meets sort of certain requirements, you know, if the transaction is structured unnaturally or there are uncommon relationships created between parties, then SARS could tax that in a certain way. So that's really the really interesting thing. Is the question is does the tax avoidance that is employed in some of these cases, would that withstand scrutiny under the domestic laws of the states in which some of these persons are resident?
Is that why offshore investments are so finely tuned in terms of the way it's structured, is to avoid tax liabilities in a investor's territory?
Yeah, that's often the aim. So, you know, for example, there are different sort of kinds of offshore structures that are employed. And again, I'll use South Africa as an example because it's close to home and it makes it a bit easier to understand. But you know, historically, we have people try to use, before we had the tax amnesty in 2002, 3 years, you know, strictly speaking, one wasn't allowed to really externalize any funds and exchange control was slowly relaxed and so on. And then essentially what happened over time is that firstly, people tried to invest and place their funds offshore in low tax jurisdictions to avoid tax. And then we developed laws which for example, so-called rules that attribute the tax to the South African investor. So one could be taxed on the income, but you wouldn't be taxed on their assets on death or the estate duty, for example. So we've developed these anti-avoidance rules to counter these structures. But the the sort of the next step then in the where if there's no specific anti-avoidance rule and you still fall in between it, then the question arises whether these cigar rules, the general anti-avoidance rules, whether they could be applied to make a person pay tax where they otherwise wouldn't. But it is very difficult nowadays to avoid tax entirely. Just as a matter of interest, also the other issue that has also come to the fore, you might have seen internationally, there's been a push for international minimum corporate tax rate of 15% globally. So many countries have sort of agreed to this in principle. And so once we actually move to that, the question as to whether there is such a thing as not paying any tax on offshore investments, that might no longer be the case.
Louis Boerter is Senior Associate in the Tax and Exchange Control Practice at Cliff Dekker Hofmeyer, joining us in conversation this evening, shedding light on what you could do to ensure that you are compliant with your tax obligations while avoiding additional tax paid. How can SARS determine through one's individual structures that you are setting it up to avoid paying tax?
So something like that would typically... they could typically pick that up during an audit. So in terms of finding out information about your offshore holdings, obtaining that has become a lot simpler now pursuant to the so-called CRS, Common Reporting Standard, which we became a signatory to back in 2016, and which has been implemented since about 2018. So which is basically the automatic exchange information. So basically tax authorities of various countries collect information from their local financial institutions, and then they exchange it with the relevant authority. So, for example, if I had an investment, for example, in say Jersey, which is a low tax jurisdiction, I had some assets there under the CRS. The bank, the Jersey entity with which I hold my funds, they would have to report it to the Jersey authorities, and the Jersey authorities would exchange that information with SARS. So that's the one way in which SARS would become aware of my offshore holdings. And then they would have a look at, for example, SARS has a very advanced risk engine which they keep on updating over time. And so they could, for example, pick up some things that the risk engine might pick up. Does the amount of assets accord with the amount of income declared? That's the one issue. They could also then do randomized audits that would help them determine that. But it would be a process, and then only in an audit would they actually be able to fully ascertain whether there's been an underpayment of tax or not.
So hiding those assets through offshore structures made very, very difficult, as you point out, with the introduction of the Common Reporting Standard. And it sounds as if the respective tax authorities in countries are now speaking to each other, which, as you point out, does make it difficult. From an investor point of view, then, Louis, what do you need to consider when taking your investments offshore?
Yeah, so the key thing is to understand why you're doing it. So it's more difficult. So you just want to begin to take one step back on the tax avoidance issue. The principle in South African tax law, and that has been upheld in a few well-known court cases, is that a person is allowed to structure their affairs to ensure the best possible tax outcome. So you're not obliged to structure your affairs to pay the maximum amount of tax. You are allowed to structure it. Now, what our courts have not ruled on is how does this principle, how is it compatible with what I spoke about, these GAR rules which came in 2006. So that question still needs to be answered. But the bottom line is one is allowed to structure it. But the key question is why you're doing it. So if it is only for tax reasons, you need to fully understand what kind of taxes you are actually trying to avoid. Or which taxes you would actually be avoiding, because I spoke about the attribution rules, for example, that could apply. So a person needs to properly understand. And then the thing is, tax laws overseas also change. So it doesn't always. A couple of years ago, for example, The UK changed some of their laws on inheritance tax, which if one was a non-resident, a South African resident, you know, investing there, you suddenly might have been taxed on something which would not have been the case before. So often, I think the bottom line is that oftentimes it is no longer your main aim should just be to reduce your tax liability. It should be also something else, you know, maybe to diversify one's investment, to be in a, you know, different regulatory environment, which might be, maybe you might perceive it as more certain, or which might provide more security for certain types of investments. And so I think there must also nowadays, the decision to try and reduce the tax liability for offshore investment should also be accompanied by a clear commercial rationale.
And why do you think that would be a good approach?
Precisely because, it's difficult to reduce your tax liability for an offshore investment because of the laws, because there's the compliance burden. So if the tax is your only factor, I mean, you have to also think about, you know, getting tax advice. I'm not saying it's a good idea to consider it, but I just think you should take all factors into account. Tax should not be, I think, the only consideration. It's good to also make the decision taking into account other factors, such as, for example, you know, diversifying one's investments. You know, if you have the luxury of being able to invest in different jurisdictions, that is a good factor to take into account. So it's just simply a matter of saying, you know, tax can be a key consideration or a main consideration, but I don't think it should be the only consideration, because there's a lot of work that needs to be done as an administration, you know, because one also has to set up an offshore trust structure, for example. One has to, that trust, the income generated by that structure must also pay for the administrators of that offshore structure. So there are these things involved that one has to take into account. So it has to be a well-informed and well-researched decision.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, if you go through all of the trouble and all of the expertise required to do it, and it's merely to reduce your tax obligation, it does seem that it's a lot of effort for little return, in fact.
Yes. Correct. That's exactly the point. And to understand that, again, like I said, tax laws, push to change tax laws.
Are you still there? Sorry.
I'm still here.
Just lost you for a second there. Louis, where could our listeners find out further information around this?
We publish on our website, we publish an article about the Pandora Papers, well, about some of the considerations for the Pandora Papers. So they can go onto our website, cliftickerhoffmeyer.com. They can have a look. We've written an article there with some ideas, some pointers, a few things to consider, basic sort of guidelines to consider when you set up the structure, the reporting obligations, keeping good records, and so forth. So they can have a look at the article on our website, and for any further articles that we publish. These articles are free, so they can just go onto our website, and under our tax and exchange control page, they can read more about it there.
Wonderful. Louis Boerta, Senior Associate in the Tax and Exchange Control Practice at Cliff Dekker Hofmeyer. Appreciate your insights on this and your time, Louis. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Anita. Have a good evening. Take care.
What I love about chatting to Louis is that he makes these complicated tax matters. He explains it in layman's terms, because ordinarily on the face of it, when you talk tax, you may as well speak gibberish to me, because it's over the top, so to speak. But wonderful getting the insights from Louis, speaking plainly, joining us in conversation this evening on The Honest Truth. You're welcome to catch up.